I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back for a brand new episode of Collider Ladies Night. I am beyond thrilled to have Julia Stiles on the show today in celebration of Riviera. Hello, and how is everything going?
Hi, good. I mean, good. It's just, you'd think after like a year of doing Zoom interviews, I'd figure it out. But there's a reason we hire technicians and hair and makeup people and all that. So
I'm showing off a pretty new Ladies Night game for you right now. We call it Dicey Questions. Basically, I have too many questions and we don't have enough time. So I came up with 8 questions. And I'm going to roll the die 3 times. And that's how we're going to decide what 3 questions we start with at least. So
great.
Here we go. I got a 7. 7, we're calling that's a wrap. What is the strangest wrap gift you've ever received?
Oh God, a riding crop? Like that thing that you whip a horse with? This is a long time ago. And it was very inappropriate. Or maybe it was a joke. I don't know. It was a play that I did called Oleana, and Aaron Eckhart and I were the only 2 characters in it. So you can guess who gave me that.
Okay. All right. We're going again. I got a 1. 1 this time is, ooh, remakes. All right. So revivals, remakes, and reboots are kind of inevitable these days. So of all of your former projects, which do you think would be best served by a revival or a sequel with the original cast? And then what do you think would be best served by a complete overhaul with a new cast and a new generation of stars in it?
Oh, wow. Well, you know, I have not FOMO, but like that, I kind of want a do-over on a lot of the things that I've done, like probably everything before I was 30. So let me take advantage of this question. What would I like to do? Well, I definitely want to do over on Save the Last Dance. I would love to, because I am very critical of myself, and as dancers can be, I feel like I never got it quite right. So I would do that again with the original cast. And then I forgot the second half of the question.
Which movie that you were in do you think would be better served by a complete overhaul, like a new generation stepping in to create a new version of that particular story?
Okay. Without insulting the original movie.
There's value in modernizing things, I think, and repeating stories for that point.
Right. I also would see Save the Last Dance modernized because we're still dealing with a lot of the issues that came up in it.
All right, 1 more. We got a 3. Number 3 is filmmaking 101. What is a seemingly silly question about the way that films and shows are made that you were afraid to ask when you were first starting out?
Oh, I mean, the only thing that comes to mind is it was actually a theater thing. It was one of the very first plays I ever did. They said, okay, everybody take 5. And I was like, what does take 5 mean? It means take a 5-minute break, but I didn't know that at the time.
That's very fair. All right, I'm going to start with Ghostwriter here, because I know you've said that you're a bit embarrassed by the clip that's floating around out there, but was there anything about working on that particular set with that group of people that looking back makes you go, you know, I'm glad that that was my first on-screen gig?
Well, of course I'm glad. I mean, I, when you're starting out as an actor, you just want to get work, right? You just want to be hired. So I was like, I was obviously thrilled to get the job, and I had a lot of fun with the costumes, and that's one of the reasons I became an actress, was so I could play dress up and play pretend. So it's not even that I'm embarrassed. It's just like, if you saw, you know, it's just like, if you had a like a home video of yourself at 12 years old or whatever I was, maybe I was 14, I don't know. And it was sort of broadcast all over the internet, you'd be like, okay, let's just move on.
When you're first starting out and you want to get as much experience as possible, what is it like balancing that mentality, but also the fact that even when you're just starting out, you kind of want to curate your filmography that really speaks to the projects and the roles that, you know, I guess, speak to the type of career path you want to carve for yourself?
About curating a career for myself, I wasn't thinking that strategically. I was just like, A, please hire me. And then as I started to, you know, work more, then I was more like, oh, I'd like to travel there, or this seems like a fun thing to go to, you know, go to work every day and wake up in the morning and work with these people or play this character. So it was a lot more whimsical, I guess, than later in my career. Now I'm a bit more thoughtful about making choices in terms of what I want to put out there and what I want to work on, but not when I was 18, 19, 20, all the way up, probably yesterday.
We're going to get into how that evolved a bit more, but first, 10 things I hate about you. You know, it had to come up, but it's seriously one of my all-time favorites. So I know that you've said that the role of Kat popped for you because she was different from a lot of the other teen comedy leads we had been seeing at the time. So it was making me wonder, because I know there can be a lot of crossover in the audition scene. Were you ever being offered auditions for some of those other projects that were in that similar sphere? And do you think maybe you got the role of Kat because that clicked for you on that level?
100%. I in my early auditioning years, especially because I was kind of an angsty teenager, or I don't know, or maybe more serious or thoughtful, when I would audition for commercials, I remember in particular, they would always tell me, oh, you're so serious, you're too, you know, intellectual, like be more bubbly, be more effervescent. And of course, it's like asking a woman to smile. You're like, then I read Kat, and it just completely jumped off the page to me. I thought, wow, this is so refreshing. This girl is feisty and opinionated and unapologetic. And if I wasn't that, I wanted to be that. And so it was so exciting for me to get the role and then also have other people respond to her the same way that I did.
Going into O here, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think O might have been one of the first times that you worked with a director who was also a prolific actor. So actually, maybe minus, I guess, M. Night Shyamalan's cameos in his own movies. But could you feel a difference on that set working with Tim Blake Nelson, and any, you know, unique quality to his directing style that reflected his acting sensibilities?
Yeah, definitely. He was very, very much paying attention to the actors, you know, and that doesn't always happen with movies. Sometimes they're much more concerned with the image, or they sort of, a director who doesn't come from an acting background can not really understand, like, what it, you know, you can't just tell somebody to start crying. There's a whole internal process that has to happen, or whatever it is. But I think Tim Nelson, because of his acting background, was so respectful of us, and sensitive to what we needed, but also didn't use kid gloves. Like he treated us like grownups, even though we were kind of not yet grownups. And I think he also, the movie as a whole, because of his background with Shakespeare, he really wanted to, even though we weren't speaking in verse, like he really wanted to respect that it was an adaptation of Othello. So it gave it kind of a more maturity, I guess.
I guess a similar question, but in more of a general way, was there any specific cast member or filmmaker that you worked with in the early days of your career that inspired you in a way that made you think, you know, it's not just about the fact that I want to do this, but that right there, that's how I want to do it.
I mean, I definitely, Paul Greengrass comes to mind. He just is such an inspirational director in that he's so respectful of the cast and the crew, no matter what, where you fall in the hierarchy. But he has such a clear vision, and then also comes to set with a smile on his face and telling jokes. And it was just, he set such a nice tone and atmosphere, even, you know, when there's millions of dollars at stake and there's obviously a lot of pressure on him. So yeah, I would say he's definitely an inspiration.
Solid choice right there. Going back to the Shakespeare of it all in the earlier days of your career. I mean, we all know how the industry likes to box folks into what they do and what they do well. So was there ever anyone on your team saying, you know, I know you want to do this, but like, be careful. You don't want to be the one who does all the Shakespeare adaptations.
I feel like it was the opposite. I feel like I was the one who was saying, I don't want to do all the, I'm so grateful for all my opportunities, but I don't want to just be playing one thing. I wanted versatility in the types of movies that I was in, and then also the types of characters that I was playing. I don't know how much control actors really have over their own careers, so I don't know, you be the judge.
Well, for what it's worth, within the little Shakespeare box, I feel like you have a nice amount of variety with those three adaptations. But given what you just said, is there any specific point where you started to feel like more control was in your hands? And I mean, even if you feel like you have that at this point.
I think maybe, yeah, only recently. I mean, only in the last 5 years, I want to say, maybe 5 or 10 years. Nothing really had changed in terms of what I was being offered or anything in the industry. It's more just my becoming more thoughtful about choices that I was making, and you know, really pushing for certain roles that I wanted, like the role in Hustlers. I really loved that script, and the part really spoke to me, and the subject matter really spoke to me, and I knew that Laureen Scafaria was going to do an amazing job with it, and so I really like advocated to be in it, which, you know, years before that I probably would have been more passive, I guess.
I understand that. I'm glad you fought for that one. I love that movie. Going into making the decision to go to college, when you made the decision to, I guess, kind of step away from the industry a little bit and focus on getting your degree, was it just a matter of, you know, you always knew you wanted to go to college and that was the age when it happened? Was it about anything that happened in your career that made you think that this is an important part of my life that I know I need to have?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I remember thinking, I want to go to college because I want to have, or I want to at least start, because I want to have whatever the normal college experience is, or the experience that my peers would be having. And then I do also remember thinking, so bizarre, when I was thinking when I turn 40, I don't want to be talking to, I don't want to be a grown, whatever we think of that being, you know, at 20. I thought, I don't want to be sitting around like talking to producers or studio executives or writers and directors, grown-ups, my what I thought was grown-ups, and not be able to like hold my own, you know. And then we can get into the whole thing of like what, yeah, I just remember thinking, I want to have that behind me. I don't know.
Now at this point, do you feel like having that behind you is making a big difference?
No, I mean, you know, having a college degree, like, sure, I'm grateful that I could afford to do that. I'm grateful that I did do it. But I don't know that it necessarily translates to filmmaking. It's one piece of a bigger puzzle. Like a lot of my experience on set in the time that I've been working has informed, you know, has educated me and informed who I am now just as much. But
you did get an English degree. So with that in mind, did that experience of pursuing that degree maybe influence how you read scripts or the specific roles that you gravitate towards?
I definitely think, yes. I definitely think that, like, when I first finished school, I thought, well, you know, there's a joke, like an English major is a jack of all trades, but a master of none, or what does an English degree really do, unless you're going to be a writer or a teacher, whatever. But I actually think that I've only recently learned that, like, oh, I learned a lot about storytelling. I learned a lot about how, you know, classical storytelling, like a three-act structure, but then also just, yeah, how to character and conflict and drama, comedy, how to tell a story, whatever medium it is, whether it's, you know, a film, a TV show, on stage. So it was incredibly useful. I just didn't realize it at the time.
I also love talking about bumps in the road and how you might have overcome them. And I was reading another interview you did where you mentioned feeling out of place in Hollywood. So having gone through that experience, what would you say to someone else out there who might run into a similar challenge, especially when it comes into, I guess, I don't know, transitioning to the next phase of a career?
Well, I think now, you know, I realize more and more Hollywood, whatever, is not one thing, and it's not a fixed thing. You know, it's made up of people, and it's made up of business people and creative people, and that's a fluid thing, that's changing. So, like, when I first started out acting, the industry was really, really different than it is now. So you could feel out of place in it, but you can also affect it and change it in an ideal world.
I definitely like that outlook on it now. At that time, when you were going through it, did you have any peers that you could talk to about it and kind of bat around ideas with in terms of what you could be doing to change the situation then?
Not really. I don't want to say I was antisocial, but I was maybe introverted or a bit shy early in my career. So I wasn't, most of my friends were not in the industry. And then now I think that's changed a little bit. Like when I'm on a film set, I'm a lot more social and collaborative. But yeah, when I was first starting out, no, I kind of ran in the other direction. I went off to school and buried my face in some books, you know. It's more fun now, I have to say.
I understand that. Going into yet another thing that I read that you've said in the past, it was about interviews and something about not being quoted before you're 20-something. So it did make me wonder what I'm kind of asking you to do my job for me, but for, you know, 20-something actors, up and coming actors out there, what question do you wish was asked of them more that you would have appreciated at that age?
I think back then there were a lot more, and this has changed. I think there were a lot more questions about, like, what is your diet and exercise routine, and what are you wearing, and what are you like what designers are you wearing, or yeah, it was a lot, I guess, more superficial, and obviously that's changed, I think. So what would I wish that they would have asked more? I guess I would have wished, you know, I don't know. you know, it's more, I actually think I was really lucky that, even though I do feel like I shouldn't have been quoted in print, still trying to figure out how to navigate becoming famous. I feel like, or you know, even just growing up, I feel like it's harder now for up and coming actors because of the nature of the internet and social media and the way that you say one thing and it's there forever, you know?
Absolutely, know that all too well. Let's go into another title here. How about revisiting Saturday Night Live? I mean, looking back, what was the most surprising thing about the process of hosting an episode of the show?
How I want a do-over on it all, or not a, you know, but I mean, how fun. It was so fun. I'm obsessed with that show. I love that show. I look forward to it still every weekend. And I was just along for the ride. I mean, you know, it's such a well-oiled machine. You're literally just being, like, dragged in between sketches, dragged across the set. Somebody pops a wig on you, changes your clothes, and then you're off to read the next cue cards. But it was so great. And I'd love to do it again.
If there's an opportunity to do it again, is there anything from the previous time, you know, an item on the to-do list that you didn't get to tick that you would want to do on the next go around?
Anything. I'm up for anything.
I feel like that's what you're supposed to be thinking when you approach a show like that.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's get into some Bourne now. I know that Nikki was originally meant to die in the Bourne Identity. So can you walk us through what the process was like in terms of finding out that she wasn't going to anymore? Because if I know my information properly on this, you shot the film as though she was going to die and then found out in post that that was not the case anymore, right?
Yeah, it was a complete surprise to me. I filmed a scene where I think it was Matt Damon or maybe it was Chris Cooper. Jason Bourne flips Nikki upside down against a wall and I break my neck. And so as far as I knew, that was it for Nikki Parsons. And then I don't remember if it was in post-production or if it was like when the movie came out. No, it was. I went to go do ADR and record sound, and I had they needed to have sounds of me breathing so that we knew that she was still alive.
Oh my. So many more questions. First, at that time, what was your feeling on film franchises? And I guess, did they even know that Bourne would spawn a franchise at that point anyway?
Well, there's no guarantee. I mean, I think they were hoping that it would, but there's no guarantee. And at the time, Matt Damon was a very respected actor and well-known, but he wasn't necessarily by the studio system considered an action star. And it was, for its time, like visually very groundbreaking, you know, with the handheld cameras and the, it didn't look like your typical action movie. So I remember there was no guarantee that there was gonna be, you know, four movies or after that.
So at what point do they, you know, scramble to whip up a multi-film contract so they can keep you involved?
I think each film we would have terms of if they do make a sequel, but it's always up to the studio to decide.
All right, Dexter time. What would you say is the biggest surprise about stepping into such a well-oiled machine? Or more specifically, do you find it more or less challenging to create a character in a pre-established world and with a cast and crew that have a pre-established workflow?
It was great. It was my first introduction to really like a cable drama. And I remember back then, cable had just started to become great and really appealing to actors. And I had always had this fear of, if you sign up for a TV show, which would be like a 6-year contract, is it gonna end up being something that you didn't anticipate or something that wasn't really what you signed up for? And Dexter totally changed my mind about that. So that then I could go on and do Riviera. And feel really confident that like working on a 13 episode drama is a really fun job and can be really rewarding for actors. And so in some ways, like the pressure was off because I wasn't the lead on Dexter, you know, I wasn't a series regular, but to come in and have, I loved what they wrote for me, and to come in and be able to play that part for one season was really great. And it made me want to do more TV.
Speaking of that, television has evolved quite a bit over the last 10 years. So how much would you say the experience of making a TV show changed between Dexter and Riviera? I guess, how do you think it's changed maybe for the better? And then also alternatively, did you have any experiences on Dexter that you wish were still more common today?
Well, I remember this was a little before Dexter, but when I first started acting, there was a big divide between film actors and TV actors. Film actors had this idea of like, I don't want to do TV because then I'm going to be only on TV. And I think TV actors really aspired to be in film. And that's totally changed. And then, you know, certainly I was paying attention to that sort of thing between Dexter and Riviera. And now it's like a job on a cable television show is one of the most coveted, you know, gigs.
Absolutely. I wanted to ask you about the Emmy also, because I'm just always curious about the reality of getting nominated for a big award like that. Does it really change the game career-wise in any capacity? Are you all of a sudden being offered more television opportunities like that?
I don't know. I don't think so. And here's the humble pie that I got to eat. I was nominated for a Golden Globe, which was like a huge dream come true for me. But at the Golden Globes, when they show the nominees and they announce like so-and-so, a best, you know, guest in a TV show and they say the names and the person that they're playing in the show that they're on. When they cut to me, they cut to the wrong person in the audience. So I wasn't, it was like one of our producers, you know, it's that sort of thing. So it's like, it's all the highs and lows of this business.
Yeah.
You can never, you know, I went to another award ceremony and it was the BAFTAs. And so you had the British thing on top of it. And I was like, oh my, you know, starstruck and feeling really great about myself. And then they spelled my name wrong on the place card. So it's like, you can't take yourself too seriously, or just don't get too excited. Don't get too appreciated, but don't get too excited.
All right, going into Riviera, going back to the beginning, because we're introducing our audience to the show right now. What was it about the project that made you say, this is a project or a role that I need to take? Because I've never done this specific thing yet, and I really want to do it.
Yes, I feel like I'm often, or at least I like advice I would give other people is that if something scares you or feels like unknown territory, that's probably a good reason to do it. I'm trying to think of what... I did a movie called It's a Disaster that was a comedy with David Cross and America Ferrera. And it was a great script, but it was also largely improvisational and it was all comedians. And I had never really done anything like that before. And I was a little worried if I was going to be able to keep up, but it was like one of the best, most fun things I've ever worked on.
So then jumping into Riviera, what was the thing that made you go, you know, this is new to me and this scares me, but that also excites me?
Well, it was exciting because of the setting and where I'd get to travel and being the lead on a TV show, but it was also scary for those reasons because it means you pack up your life and you go move to another country for 7 months. Although I would do that again in a heartbeat. And it's also, you don't know again what you're signing up for 3 seasons later. So I'm really proud of the third season and I think it got bigger and more exciting and more intriguing. So it was incredibly rewarding. But when I signed on for season 1, I had only read the pilot, the first episode, and got like a synopsis of what was going to happen later in season 1.
I want to highlight, I mean, every single person in this ensemble, but we don't have time for that. So in an effort to at least highlight 2 individuals, of everyone in the Riviera cast, whose process would you say aligns with yours the most, where you instantly fell into step with them? And then who challenged you to adapt to what they like to do? And maybe that was for the better and made you try something new.
I loved working with Lena Olin. And I felt like I loved our mornings next to each other in the hair and makeup chairs. And then watching her work, because I just learned so much from her. And then also, yeah, I remember falling out of, like, sometimes we would be doing a scene together and I would fall out of it because I was just so riveted by her performance that I got distracted. And then Rupert Graves, who plays Georgina's right-hand man in season 3. I just love that he's like, he can, it's a particularly British thing, I think, in terms of like the training that they have. He could turn it on and off, you know, cameras are rolling, he's incredibly focused, he's in the scene, they call cut and he's talking about football and making jokes and just like so committed and so invested and gives it his all, but also doesn't take it too seriously and isn't too precious about the work that he's doing.
So do you prefer doing the opposite when you have the opportunity, just like staying locked in and in that environment and in that character?
No, I like to break out of it. I like to break out of it. I feel like there's a freshness that happens when you're not, it's like you need to give yours mentally a break from whatever you're doing. And I also learned a lot. I made a couple of short films and stepping inside an editing room really taught me that like, it's better to be free and play around and give options as an actor, as opposed to just being like locked into, I want my performance to be this, because there's so much that can be done in editing if a director has options.
Bringing up your work behind the camera, what about when it comes to actual production? Is there any role in a film company that you gained a greater appreciation for when you actually made your own shorts?
Well, it's a group effort. I mean, everyone is kind of essential. You can't make a movie by yourself. I mean, you could, but I don't know how good it would be. So yeah, I mean, everyone is essential.
Maybe an unsung hero of a film crew. Someone who just doesn't really get the credit that they deserve.
Script supervisor really has to hold it together. But I would say I would say, this is a job that can be done not well often, but the assistant directors, who are the ones who keep the schedule going and keep and go to the cast and like say it's time to go on set, they that is such a huge important part because it sets the tone. And if you have somebody yelling or you have someone who just even is on edge and they're the first person to talk to the actor in the morning, you're gonna then it's unless it's like a superhero actor, they're gonna affect, they can make it that much, you know. I don't want to be too precious about actors, but we do at a certain point, we're waiting around. And then there is this subtle underlying pressure that we all feel of like, you better be able to perform as soon as we roll that camera, because otherwise, you know, it'll all fall apart. And so the assistant director is like, you know, they just affect your mood. And I would also say hair and makeup people too. Yeah, that's my quick answer, hair and makeup.
So with Riviera, I would say there's a lot of, I guess, eccentric and over the top components to it. So what would you say is maybe the most holy shit quality of the lifestyle on the Riviera? And then also of the art industry that you learned about while you were prepping for the show?
I mean, every day was a holy shit moment on that set, because you'd be in like, and it just got more and more holy shit because, you know, I've experienced a little bit of that kind of luxury through Hollywood, through the work that or my career, but I don't come from it. And so I think of season one, it was like, we get to ride in a helicopter. Awesome. And then season two, it would be like, we get to go on a yacht, or like a luxury yacht. Like somebody actually owns this boat and goes sailing around the world with it. How does that happen? And then it was like, you know, private jet, and oh, I get to ride in a Ferrari. I never thought I was going to do that in my life. You know, it's all ridiculous, but it was fun to dip my toe in.
How do you think that your run on this show is going to wind up influencing the roles and projects you commit to moving forward, and maybe the capacity that you want to commit to those projects? Because I also know that you're producing here too.
I was an executive producer on season three. It seemed like the natural thing to do, just because I was really involved in collaborating with the writers in terms of our storytelling. How do I answer that question? I don't know.
We won't hold you to it. That answer can change and evolve. That's kind of the point.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking like other things that I've worked on since Riviera, sometimes I don't have to look picture perfect, but then sometimes I'm like, wait a minute, no, I need some mascara, stop. So I don't know, it changes on a day-to-day basis, like what, how much I miss from Riviera and how much I'm excited for, you know, trying other things.
Projects like the new Orphan movie, which I'm ridiculously excited about.
Thank you. Yeah, it's exciting. It was fun to work on. And I do not watch horror movies. And when I was sent the script for it, I was like, I don't know, I'm not into that genre. But then, and I was also really worried about going back to work after COVID, and the script was so dang good, I couldn't put it down. And I was so surprised by the twist that I'm not going to give away, that I think you'll like it.
Avoiding any spoilers or twists, because you're someone who doesn't necessarily gravitate towards watching horror movies, what is a quality about this new Orphan movie that, you know, I guess scratch that itch for you that other ones don't?
It's incredibly psychological. You know, I'm not really interested in blood and gore, and I don't find that, I find it gross, but I don't find it really scary. What I find scary is the stuff that happens up here. And the Isabel Furman's character, Esther, although she has multiple names, Lena, I don't know, it's just such a fascinating, especially now because she's a grown-up, she's 23 now playing the same part. It's like, it's just such a fascinating sociopathic character. I mean, along the lines of why Norman Bates was so interesting to watch.
That comparison makes me even more excited, and I didn't think that was possible. I have to let you go soon. We are going to wind this down with a top three. So as someone who stars in one of the most iconic teen romantic comedies of the 90s, a personal favorite of mine, can you list your own personal top three? And it not include 10 things, maybe.
Oh, of a romantic comedies?
Teen romantic comedies from the 90s.
Okay. Well, can I do one drama too?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So top romantic drama, hugely influential, Romeo and Juliet with Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes. Oh, I love that movie. And it just broke all boundaries, or whatever the expression is. And then comedies, okay. From the 90s. See, I'm such a child of the 80s, but I guess, okay. You think I'd be prepared for a question like this? give me a sec. I mean, I'm thinking Drew Barrymore. I feel like there were a ton of romantic comedies that I love Drew Barrymore in.
Never Been Kissed.
And then also, this maybe was later than the 90s, but the baseball one that she did with Jimmy Fallon, Fever Pitch.
Yes, Fever Pitch is a good one.
That's a good one.
I'll rattle off some titles for you. What about, Clueless, She's All That, Can't Hurt.
Oh, yes. Well, Clueless was huge. Clueless was so fun. That was huge. That was a good one. Okay, that might knock one of the other ones out.
Good solid list there.
Yeah.
All right. We always end Ladies Night with the same two questions. First one is, who is someone that you think is changing the industry for the better?
Emerald Fennell, I think is how you pronounce her name. I Promising Young Woman was just like the mind blown emoji, the puffy cloud over the head, just describes, I couldn't stop telling all my friends about it. And I'm so glad it got the attention that it deserved in terms of Oscars. Emerald Fennell, and then also Phoebe Waller-Bridge, obviously. Like they're changing content out there, and they're doing it from behind the camera too.
Excellent choices right there. Our last question is a little bit of a heavy one. You could take it in a lighter direction if you prefer. What is the biggest fear that you've ever had that you've actually managed to overcome?
Oh, have I? I mean, I want to say that I was going to say like I have a huge fear of rats and pigeons, but I don't want to even open up that challenge. So I've not overcome that fear. I would say I'm working on my fear of heights. I feel like I've been in a lot of situations at work where they're like, do you have a fear of heights? As we're about to go do some stunt off of a mountainside or whatever. And so I'm sort of getting better at that.
I got to let you go. And before I do, I'm going to tell everybody out there that season 2 of Riviera, it's going to kick off on Ovation TV on Saturday, May 8th. And then episodes are going to be available on the Ovation Now app the next day. So do check it out. It is a binge-worthy show, so just be warned, once you press play, it's not going to stop. So carve out a lot of time. Julia, thank you so much for hanging out with us, and big congrats on the show.
Thank you. Thanks. Nice to talk to you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.